Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the show. Yeah, here at NOLA Drinks, we always think it's great when taxpayers have to pay for a PR trip to try and buoy up a failing golf course in Scotland. Hey, we got a good show coming up for you today. We're going to jump right into it. We are chatting with Gary Solomon Jr., first off, co-chair of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. That fantastic event, if you're listening on the radio, kicks off tomorrow. It's happening now. So we're going to chat with Gary. And then we are going to chat with Ian McNulty, the restaurant and food writer for the New Orleans Advocate newspaper. Both those guys stick around for an extended conversation, another shot with NOLA Drinks. So if you're listening on the radio, be sure to get the podcast. And hey, there you go. We want to give a special shout out to our good friends there at Sylvain, who hosted us when we chatted with Gary Solomon Jr. from Tales, and our good friends at Two Jags, the fantastic second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, for hosting us when we talked to Ian McNulty. Hey, we're going to jump right in with Gary, then we're going to be back there with Ian, as I just said, and then stick around for another shot with NOLA Drinks, friends. All right, everybody, here we are at Sylvain, one of my favorite restaurants here in the French Quarter, and I am pleased to be joined by my special guest here, Gary Solomon Jr. of the Solomon family, as well as the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here. I love this restaurant, too.
Yeah, it's a great place, isn't it?
I've had a lot of late nights here.
Yeah, that makes two of us. Actually, I kind of tend to start earlier here because I'm a little bit older, so I start early and then burn out early.
For me, it's where I come for a really good meal when it's late.
Okay.
You know, and it's like 11:30 or midnight, and it's like, I know I can really get a legit meal here still, and I'm not eating street food. That's when I usually end up here, and then I somehow stay till 2 in the morning. So
it does do that to you here at Sylvain, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, Gary, so on previous shows recently, we've talked to your partner, the co-chair of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation, our good friend Neil Bodenheimer, and then also just very recently, Caroline Rosen, who is the newish, as I keep saying, executive director
of
the foundation. Everybody's new, exactly. Yeah. You're all newish. It's been February or so, right? So,
yeah.
And so we're sort of completing the triumvirate here on this particular episode of the show and speaking with you. And it's been interesting talking with everybody, and here airing on the radio, this is the eve of Tales of the Cocktail and the podcast whenever you're hearing it, but presumably during Tales of the Cocktail. Let's talk a little bit about your background as part of being part of the Solomon family, obviously a longstanding and philanthropic family here in New Orleans.
Yeah, our family's been here since 1969. Family's been in the South for four generations, but moved here in 69. And we were always raised that, you know, we were always blessed and lucky to have businesses that were successful. And it was always part of our DNA that giving back was not an option. It was a requirement. And so, you know, I'm really lucky that we get a chance to work with New Orleans nonprofits and nonprofits all across the world now through this vehicle, the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's coming from your broader philanthropic background, so that seems like it was a very natural fit to get involved with, both get involved with Tales of the Cocktail Foundation, but then also shape it into what you all are doing now as an educational foundation.
So, you know, we looked at this opportunity and there was, you know, the chance that if Tales had been purchased by an out-of-town buyer, it very likely could have moved. Not saying it would have, but it very likely could have moved, depending on who the buyer was. And we were motivated purely from a civic standpoint to want to keep it here in New Orleans. July, we're here in July. You're looking around. There's nothing happening right now except for Tales.
Right.
Essence just happened, and that was tremendous and exciting. But if not for Tales, the summer months, you know, really become dead after Essence and don't pick up until, you know, kids are back in school and hurricane season ends. So we were interested in just keeping Tales here in New Orleans. That was the first reason we got involved. But then when we got to understand the issues that were the challenges that the hospitality and drinks community were facing, issues that were impacting a lot of industries, in fact, happened to be happening inside the drinks and spirits industry as well, they aligned with some of the causes and the issues that we as family cared about. Issues like addiction, sexual misconduct, advancement in education, just across the board. We started looking at these things and we said, this isn't just an opportunity to keep something that's important for New Orleans. In New Orleans, it's an opportunity to do good across the world and to touch an industry that could be the poster child for how we advance certain matters like these in other industries as well. So that's what drew us to it. But we knew we needed a really good partner that knew drinks. Mm-hmm. And obviously we went to Neil because, I mean, he's the drinks guy in New Orleans, at least as we knew it. And I've gotten to meet so many others since then, but that's what drew us to it originally.
That makes a lot of sense, Gary. And I think you made a good choice with Neil, by the way. See, the guy just got a beard award. So, I mean, somebody thinks he knows what
timing
he's doing.
Was good. I don't think he would have said yes if we asked him after the beard award.
After the beard
his,
award.
His value right. went up tremendously.
Exactly right. Well, and you raise a great point. And one of the things that we talk about on this show quite often is that in the service and hospitality industry, and New Orleans is no different, probably even more exemplary than many places. It is where the rubber hits the road in so many ways with, like you said, with issues of addiction, issues of sexual harassment, issues of diversity. And I think it's a good that you guys see that because I think it's, some people just kind of perceive it as it's a good time out, but this is a very unique interface that we have in this particular industry.
Yeah, it's striking. And it's something I did not understand until the last few months of really being more deeply involved in this organization and being able to meet people and hear directly from those that are the power behind the hospitality industry. That's every bartender I've met, I would consider in that category. And hearing that there is this schism between, you know, the good time that has to happen for the patrons and that this is real life for those that work in it, and it's the way that they feed their families, and that there's a bit of a clash that happens there sometimes. And so I think there's got to be a balance that can be found where, you know, we love having a great time. There's a reason this event's in New Orleans. There's a reason that people get drawn to this industry in general, right?
Is to
roll out the red carpet of hospitality, share it with other people, and have a good time doing so. But there's some real serious issues that need to be addressed, and I think that's what motivated us not just to get involved, but to really commit to this, because I think that we can make a difference. And I think that it's going to be an important point this year, now that everyone's here for Tales, to prove that this organization has staying power and to kind of give a glimpse of what the future of it might be and the changes it can make in the world.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Let me ask you this question, Gary, and we don't have to go into the dirty details of any
sure.
of this, but how did the opportunity present itself? Because I didn't know that you weren't as quite tightly connected to the hospitality industry, say, as Neil is.
Yeah.
So how did this opportunity present itself to you, or how did you become aware of it and want to seize upon it?
I was, through my business, my business is an event production company. I build right. museum exhibits and events all around the country. We'd worked on some of the Tales events in past years, not in a really heavy way, but, you know, bits and bobs that we've worked on. And so we've gotten to know the event quite well just from seeing it from a couple different angles. And, you know, we knew the previous ownership and respected what the event had grown into. I'm really amazed by it, in fact. And I think locals don't quite get it, actually. Mm-hmm. I think they think it's just another one of those festivals, and it's not just another festival. I mean, it's a worldwide destination. It's right. just incredible in that way. But we were familiar with it by way of the work we did on the events themselves. And when the opportunity, look, it was common knowledge that it was going to go for sale and that there were certain people that were considering purchasing it. And so we threw our hat in the ring. We were approached by someone who was a friend of both the buyer, the eventual buyers, which is us, and the sellers, and said, you guys really should talk about this. There's really something worth looking at here. And they brought us to the table together. We drew in Neil immediately, and Neil confirmed some of the assumptions we had about it and gave us a lot more insight into things we didn't know. And that's how we ended up here.
Got it. Thank you for telling that story. I think it's interesting. And when Neil and I had chatted before about it, I was not aware of that in particular. And I know one of the things, though, that makes a strong connection, and you've made this point, and we got a couple minutes left, Gary, before we need to take a break.
Sure.
Both what you have said and what Neil has said is understanding the importance of keeping the particular event Tales of the Cocktail, the anchor event for the foundation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of other stuff goes on here in New Orleans is quintessential.
It is. I mean, we would not have done this had it been somewhere else. We fell in love with the concept that it could be anywhere after the fact, but the reason we did this, the catalyst, was to keep it here. Our family's been in, you know, New Orleans again since the late 60s. We all know what the summer months look like, and I just can't imagine a summer without Tales. And all my friends who are in restaurants and the bar industry, I mean, they say that they would probably, you know, become seasonal businesses, truly shut their doors after Essence Festival is over, if not for Tales. So right. it'd be a terrible thing to see.
It's a significant shot in the arm economically. I think the latest estimate that I read, going back to maybe last year before, was about $18 million.
That's right.
Over 4 or 5 days, 5 days, 6 days yeah. now, I guess. And I don't want to understate how important that number is in the third week of July, as we're noting here. That is a significant economic shot in the arm, especially to the hospitality industry, which is the backbone of the tourism industry, which is the backbone right. of the city's economy.
Yep. No, it's totally true. You talk to our friends, Steve Perry and Mark Romig, and the folks at the New Orleans and Tourism Marketing Corporation and New Orleans and Company, which was the CVB and now rebranded. They all say
I have a hard time with sticking.
There's a lot of new names. It's awesome. Nonetheless, they all say the same thing, that $18 million means way more. It means a lot no matter when it is, but it means a tremendous amount to the hospitality industry in July.
In July.
Yeah.
Let's do this, Gary. Let's take a little break here, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more with you.
All right.
All right, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back.
I got to have it.
Wine, wine, wine.
I got to have it.
Wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening to the show today. Yes, we are here chatting with Gary Solomon Jr. of the Solomon Family and Tales of the Cocktail Foundation, and also the Solomon Group, the production company that we were talking about that he owns. And so, Gary, here we are, if you're listening on the radio anyway, on the eve of Tales of the Cocktail, and we're actually taping this a few days in advance, but I'm guessing that things are happening at a bit of a breakneck pace right now.
Yeah, the countdown clock seems to be ticking even faster than it has been. We were looking at every day the team was sending out a note to us, 42 days to Tales, 41 days to Tales, and now that it's, is in the single digits, it's particularly a lot of heartburn in the morning when I see that. But it's exciting. I mean, everything is coming together quite nicely. A lot of the old team is still in place. There's some new faces involved, which are shaking things up a little bit too. I think it'll be a really good mix of all the best of Tales, the greatest hits, mm-hmm. and a couple new tracks as well. So I'm excited about it. I think that Neil and Caroline and I and the team have worked together for the last several months really to figure out what the audience wants and make sure we give it to them.
Mm-hmm. That brings up something really interesting, Gary, I think, because a lot of people come to Tales and they have a general understanding from the perspective of being an attendee, and they know they're attending a trade conference, largest trade conference of spirits and bartenders in the world, quite frankly. But also then, we've heard some of the background noise and some of these things. How are you guys going to take some steps to say, this is still, like you just said, this is the greatest hits, but here's the new stuff? That's got to be a bit of a challenge, I'm going to guess.
We're not going to do it all in year one.
Sure, of course not. Yeah.
Part of the job is just to stabilize this and make sure we all know that it's got staying power. Look, we've changed some things about it, no doubt. We've looked at how the educational seminars are programmed, the schedule for them, the prices on them, the kind of different tracks and levels of advanced education you can get, and tried to make sure we're putting the right people in the right seats for where they are on the continuum of their own education. Mm-hmm. We've looked at the strategy with regard to the ticket pricing to make sure that if you want to go to a tasting room, you just buy the tasting room. You don't need to displace people out of seminars to get into tasting rooms. That's really where the consumers are more likely, or the cocktail enthusiasts right. want to be. So we actually brought the price down to get in the tasting rooms for cocktail enthusiasts to just go there and not take up valuable educational space for a working bartender who really wants to advance their craft. And we created a whole new track called the 101 track, which is more foundational education about certain categories of spirits. I think the prices on those are like $35 instead of $65. So saying, look, if you're younger in your career or younger in your depth of knowledge, and you need a bit more of an intro course, you don't pay the same rate for super high-end education that you do for a little more basic foundations. You'll probably find me in the basic foundation classes. I need that. I'll see Neil probably over in the 201s, and I'll be in the 101s.
Right. Well, I think that's a great way to go about it. And I think sometimes in the past I would notice that certain educational presentations were referring to things as, say, for example, master classes or advanced this. And then I would have a lot of friends in the industry, bartenders that have been bartenders for a long time, come out with saying, I knew everything in there.
Right.
And not necessarily branding those right for the right educational level. And I think one of the exciting things that we get, so I think that's great that you're doing that. One of the things that I said recently on the show, I think in speaking to Caroline, one of my favorite things is the enthusiasm that you get. One of my favorite stories, I believe it was last year, met three guys that I think were from Des Moines, and they were the first or second craft cocktail bar to open in Iowa, or at least in the city of Des Moines. Their enthusiasm was palpable. And so we get this broad mix of people. So being able to cater that always struck me as a challenge.
But it has struck me as an incredible opportunity.
There you go.
To think of how we can, and we'll do more of this in the next year as well, but we dipped our toe in the water a bit this year with how we could create some tracks and look at the different slate of programming to really better meet people where they are in their own education and the continuum of their advanced craft. one of the things that was most amazing to me was, you know, after that very first article came out in the New York Times in the end of December that we were considering the acquisition of this and converting it into a nonprofit, people from all over the world reached out to us on Facebook, and people obviously I'd never met before. I got my Instagram requests blew up with people with, you know, profile pictures of drinks, basically. And just saying my lifelong dream is to be able to come to Tails, you know, and wishing us good luck and telling us how important it is to people. It blew me away. And that was what was so amazing, was we thought we had something really special here when we started considering it. We had no idea how special it really is to so many people. And we felt that too. When we were in Edinburgh, we had the event in the UK just a couple months ago, and it was our first Tails event under the new leadership. And UK bartenders showed up in droves, and they expressed to us just how important this is to them that we brought Tails to their city. We're spoiled. We get it here every year in New Orleans. And I don't know that locals quite get what an impact it has on people's careers and the development of the craft cocktail industry across the world. But the mecca of it is New Orleans.
Right. It's a trade conference. I think people, maybe locals, don't quite get that exactly, because we perceive it, if you're enthusiasts and you're coming, the tasting rooms, or they see the party and they see all the bartenders in town and, you know, the buyout at the Sanger to do whatever the big brand is doing. But this is, in its essence, this is a trade conference. There is professional development. It's a networking opportunity. We talked about the new folks being here. You have a lot of luminaries from the industry. And it's the one time of year where a lot of these people actually see each other and get to network, hand out resumes for that matter.
It's true. A lot of careers and brands have really taken off at Tails.
Yes.
So I hope we can create some amazing success stories that started at Tails this year too. But look, for the cocktail enthusiasts, which are the consumers, those that, you know, might not identify with some of the seminar tracks, there's a lot for them. There's the spirited dinners. There's the tasting rooms. I mean, there are certainly a lot to offer, even if being a professional, you know, professional from the spirits industry is not what your goal is. If it's just to have a better connection to the fun of the industry, there's a lot of that to be had for locals. So come and embrace it. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say they love that it's in New Orleans, the professionals, because they get to meet so many cool locals in the process.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
It's great. And hey, like, if you're, as you're saying, Gary, I think if you're a Scotch person, for example, this is an opportunity to come and maybe broaden your palate, meet the distiller, compare and contrast brands. There's a lot of interesting things. And as you said, new product launches, people use Tails as a springboard to launch new products. That's always been one of the most exciting things to me here, is being able to connect with the brand on a more personal level. And that plays on a professional level, and that plays on a personal level.
Look, first and foremost, we are here for the professional spirits industry. We're here for the bartenders, first and foremost, but there's a lot of place for the consumers, especially local New Orleanians, to have some fun and to join us doing so. So don't feel like it's out of reach. You know, there's place for everyone in this schedule, and we really, we hope the locals do embrace it and you know, roll out a really nice welcome to all our folks from around the world that are coming in and spending their money and their time to be here.
Hey, we do that. We're known for the hospitality here, right? So we are good at that. Well, Gary, we got a couple minutes left before we end the radio portion of the interview, and you're going to stick around for another shot with Noel Drinks. We talk a few more minutes. But give us a one-minute version, since you're not necessarily connected to the industry from the hospitality side. You mentioned doing some of the 101 stuff. What else are you looking forward? What's your trajectory going to be next week?
I just want to take all the operational info. I want to understand the operations of this better than I do. I've spent the last several months trying to figure out what I think the operations of how this is going to work looks like. But, you know, I'm an event and operations person by training, and so I'm really excited just to get under the hood and to see how this machine really works. Because I think the opportunity to bring this to other parts of the world with more frequency, and the opportunity to figure out how we make New Orleans bigger and better next year, it's really there for us to do so. So you might not see me doing a whole lot of drinking. You'll see me doing a lot more note-taking probably. in the earlier parts of the day, and then I'll certainly be there at the sponsor events in the evening to have some fun too.
You know, it's a taxing event in a certain sense. You got to be professional, but it's around, and you got to find that. You got to, you know, it's like you should get hazard pay, Gary, for doing this.
You're right. My partner Seth and I went to the event in the UK in Edinburgh, and it was, you know, it was only 2 or 3 days, and, you know, maybe 1/10 the size. And we got to the end of that, and we were like, that was exhausting. Mm-hmm. And I remember someone said to me, "You just wait. There's not, you haven't seen anything yet until you see the one in New Orleans."
Exactly.
We better rest up.
Well, friends, if you're listening on the radio, we are going to close out here with Gary. We're going to be back in the next couple segments. We're going to chat with Ian McNulty from The Advocate. But Gary's going to stick around on another shot with Noel Drinks, where we do our podcast-only content. So if you're not listening on the podcast and you're listening on the radio, go get that. It's going to be interesting. We're going to get a little more into the weeds, friends. We're going to take a little break here on The Noel Drinks Show. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Gary Solomon Jr., co-chair of Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. Pleased to be joined by my next guest, first-time guest on the show, I'm sorry, Ian McNulty, who is the food writer, restaurant writer for the New Orleans Advocate. Ian, it's good to see you, man.
Pleasure to be here, Brian. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely, man. It's great to finally have you on the show. I've been knowing you for a little while, but the first time I've been able to work this out. So,
well, you know, it is in New Orleans. We walk through some of the same doors in this town, that's for sure.
Yeah, indeed. Have some of the same guys' lunches and things like that.
Put our feet on the same rails, indeed. Yeah.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Well, hey, it's great having you here. And so you are the food writer, restaurant writer, man about town, as we were just talking about, for the Advocate. How did you find yourself here,
Ian? Here in New Orleans, I got here. It wasn't quite an accident, but I blame wanderlust. I was a young guy. I was 25 years old. I was back home where I grew up in Rhode Island, which is, you know, the other side of the world from New Orleans. But that was the appeal. I was looking for a place where I could run away to, basically do the romantic Hemingway run away to Europe thing. But I didn't quite have the gumption to actually go across the ocean.
I was going to say passport, but gumption. Yeah.
New Orleans, though, when you're in Rhode Island, looks pretty good, much like Europe. So I figured I'd run down here, have a wild year, do whatever I had to do to make some scratch, and then take my broke butt back home to Rhode Island and drink off those crazy French Quarter stories for all the rest of the cold winters of my life. But, you know, as it turns out, they do Mardi Gras every year here. So you want to see how it happens the next time. And pretty much you get sucked in. And, you know, I've been here 19 years now. Married a New Orleans girl eventually, which gave me a little more credibility. And, you know, I've been plying the trade ever since. But I got really, really lucky to fall into the food beat, which is, you know, I tell people it's covering, you know, not just the thing that maybe is most important in New Orleans, but the thing that people feel is closest to their heart. I mean, this is right up there with the Saints. It's covering food in this town. It's like you're covering something that everyone feels they have skin in the game on. They have a stake in, and it's fascinating. It never stops giving you stories.
We were just talking about that, Ian, before we started broadcasting here, is that there are very few places in the world, I would reckon, and certainly very few places in the United States where news in the restaurant industry is front page news, and it is here.
This astounds people in other cities. I've gotten this feedback from other people who are in the restaurant business who, you know, they can't believe the interest of these stories. And, you know, the internet, for all of its the times you want to ball it up and throw it in the trash, it gives us some incredible insight, right? So, like, the stories that you think are going to be just these little, you know, little specialty interest things, you put them online and suddenly they shoot to the top of your list of most read stories. And people in this town are wild about food. They're It's not just that they love to eat. They feel invested in the culture around the food, right? So they care about these openings and closings and trends, and in a way that even if they're not going out every night to these restaurants or can't even afford to or doesn't appeal to them, they feel it in the same way that they feel like, you know, they're, you know, Fats Domino is their guy because he's from here, even if that's not their favorite music, you know, that kind of thing. It's it's this visceral thing that people grew up here with. They know that it's part of the identity of the city. And as we know, people in New Orleans, they identify very strongly with their sense of place. Well, food is one of those things that ties them there. And restaurants, in particular, are most visible and viable and sort of invite you in kind of representation of that culture. So it's really important to people. And, you know, as a writer, it's fascinating. It can be a little overwhelming sometimes because everything is of interest, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also like a great thing to cover if you're interested in people and stories, as I am. It just gets you in the door, you know. It's wonderful to sit at these restaurants and try the food and eat and go around and try all the new stuff. And I mean, I love it. It's terrific. But when it really gets down to it, we're telling stories about people and their relationship to a city and to the future and to the past. I mean, that seems like a heavy portion, right? But when you really get into it, you can get almost anybody who cares about New Orleans food talking about their family within two questions. You know, two questions off the plate, you're somewhere in their family lineage. You know, you're somewhere in the deep, dark history of New Orleans. You can tap into people's, you know, innermost.
We can argue about your mama's red gravy.
Yeah. And that's the really amazing thing about New Orleans is if, you know, people who live here or adopted the city like I have, you know, we share this, we share a language, you know, even the people, you know, the restaurant business is a business and it's at different levels. It's different expensive restaurants, cheap restaurants, and everyone's going to go to them all. But when we're talking about New Orleans food, everybody gets that, you know, at some level, everybody gets New Orleans food.
That makes a lot of sense. It's woven into our DNA here, whether we're a transplant or not, as I'm like you, transplanted here. Well, you know, let me ask you this question, Ian, because we do have a bit of a changing landscape, I think, with the restaurant industry here.
Certainly.
And I think a lot of the bedrock, at least in my opinion, is that, you know, we've had a lot of longstanding traditional restaurants forms a lot of the foundation. We've seen a lot of volatility going on. And let's talk about it from the cultural angle, since we're really on that subject. Do you see that that's sort of changing the DNA? Do you think that's changed our perception of it?
There's a lot of angst about this subject, which just shows you that people do care about it, right? Like in other cities, new places, old places, who cares? It ran its course, right? And people, now people feel invested in these places. So, you know, it's the amount that people kind of wring their hands about it does show you that they care about it, that it's important to them. My take on it is that you know, there always has to be this turnover. There always has to be this give and take. One of the things that makes New Orleans special is that we do have these long-lived, very often family-run restaurants that go through generations from the low end to the high end. Right? They're there, and the dynamic you've seen lately of you know, more places opening, of new different places. I think it's healthy. I think it challenges people to do better. It puts more on the plate for other people. The key is that you have to kind of understand it in context. Like, this isn't just happening anywhere. This isn't just happening in Strip Mall Central, right? It's happening in a place that does have its own indigenous food culture and cuisine that's different from anywhere else in the world. And, you know, it's wonderful to have all the different options on the table. You have to appreciate that in the context of, well, this isn't just a city that's crazy about food. This is a city that has its own food, right? That has its own food culture. So even as we go around and embrace and explore and love the new flavors and test them out and see what's going to work and what's not, we always have to remember that we have this really unique cornerstone in New Orleans, that Creole identity, that New Orleans flavor. I'm not saying you have to have it every day. You know, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to set your clock by red beans and rice on Monday necessarily, but it is really good to reunite with the traditions that are New Orleans, you know?
And do you think that presents challenges? I think we've seen, and I don't want to short that conversation, but we've had a lot of people that have come down and opened restaurants, I would argue maybe out of a certain amount of naivety. If you build it, they will come. New Orleans is a magical place.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm only capitalized for 3 months, but I know how to make this well. Does that short circuit some people's ability to come in and do things if you're going to open up a concept restaurant or maybe an ethnic restaurant or something that's not quite in that mold?
There's, you know, for a long time, the knock against New Orleans food was it was great, but it all tasted the same, right? Now we have far more diversity. Well, kind of be careful what you ask for, right?
Right.
These things will sort themselves out as long as people do keep in mind what I was saying earlier, that the city does have its own base, its own cornerstone of flavor that is its own and unique. I think if there's a danger, it's that people just see New Orleans as this backdrop that's like hot and pretty and good weather all the time. And like anything goes here, it should be like anywhere else in the world. It should not. It should always be New Orleans. We can have all this other stuff and it can find its place. But you have to understand the context that you're putting it into. You know, you're not going to revolutionize New Orleans food by opening up a poke parlor or
an expensive ramen noodle joint.
Exactly. Right. That place has its place. I love that stuff.
Sure. Absolutely. But
you also have to remember that New Orleans has been doing its own thing for a long time. It is changing, but I think it's more of a gradual evolution than a, you know, throwing away the old stuff and running after the next trend. And for that, I'm grateful, and I put that gratitude into the palates of New Orleans people who grew up with this stuff and do know what it is and identify with it. And they're not going to chuck that for the next trend.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Ian, let's do this. Let's take a little break on the show. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about this. Friends, we are chatting with Ian McNulty, who is the food and restaurant writer for the New Orleans Advocate newspaper. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. Son of a gun, we're going to have big fun on the bayou. Jambalaya, crawfish pie, filet gumbo.
son of a gun, we're gonna have big fun on the bayou. Sitting here la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. Sitting here la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning into the NOLA Drink Show this evening or in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are chatting with Ian McNulty, who is the food and restaurant writer here in New Orleans for the New Orleans Advocate. And Ian, we're talking a little bit about the getting into the restaurant scene here. One of the things I think y'all did very recently and very well at the newspaper, something we've been talking about on this show quite a bit, about the restaurant industry, state of the restaurant industry, tough summer months, closures, openings, and so on and so forth. You guys actually did some of the heavy lifting and hung some numbers on some stuff. So sort of bore out a lot of the anecdotal stuff that we've been talking about and showed some interesting things.
Well, Brian, you're absolutely right about that conversation that's been going on. I mean, it's been happening for years. I've been covering the industry here for a long time. And it seemed like, you know, gosh, I want to say back around 2010, 2011, right around the time that the city hit its stride from like recovering from Hurricane Katrina to like kind of being in this new phase, you started hearing this backbeat of like, wow, there's a lot of new restaurants. Where are they all coming from? And who's going to them all? And how are they all going to survive? And what is going to survive? And you know, how much is too much? And this talk has accelerated and intensified, it seems, every year. You know, 2015, 2016, 2017, it seemed like all people were talking about in the summer, because the summer in New Orleans, as most people know, is the slowest time.
Low season.
And the summer will show you any weakness in anything, really. I mean, right. It's when all the pressures mount and the business is slow, and it'll prove things out. So what we wanted to do with the Advocate this time around at the beginning of summer was put some numbers, put some analysis behind these anecdotal conversations that I've been having with restaurateurs, and I know restaurateurs
have been
having
themselves. We've all been having these conversations, yeah.
And again, the censors around how much can the market bear? How much is too much? Are we saturated? Is there a tipping point? You know, but those things are, yeah, they're interesting to talk about. They're on people's minds, but without any data to sort of put behind, well, what are we talking about? How far can you go with it? The interesting thing is, for as much as people talk about New Orleans restaurants, finding a precise number is not an easy task. There've been some various figures that other people have calculated, but it's very subjective. So, you know, what's a restaurant? What counts as a restaurant? Where are you drawing the parameters of the market? Mm-hmm. So we decided to make it very specific. We wanted to measure the competitive landscape for restaurants in New Orleans. We wanted to have a picture of you know, if you're in the city of New Orleans, this is what you're up against. And again, it had to be pretty subjective because, you know, the lots of places serve food that are not necessarily what you would consider.
Gas
you
station,
and I would
fried
consider.
Chicken.
Right.
I like to eat, but...
Yes. Let's put it this way. You know, the supermarket down the street, you know, has a deli and people might drop in for a quick meal. Maybe that's replacing them going to a restaurant or a po' boy shop. But really, like, you know, restaurateurs are not sweating the next gas station fried chicken or supermarket to open up. They're thinking about all these different restaurants, this sort of universe, cosmos of different places to eat that are out there. So here's what we did. We contacted the state and we pulled all the records for the health inspections, for the permits for food service for New Orleans, for Orleans Parish, going back as far back as they could give us accurate, consistent data, which turned out to be 2002 in this case. So we got a lot. And this list that we got, this database, was immense. I mean, it covers everything from Two Jacques restaurant that we're sitting in to... gas stations to nursing homes to hospitals to high schools to daycare centers to American Legion, you name it, anything that has a permit for food service is on this list. And so narrowing it down and coming up with our number entailed going through line by line thousands and thousands and thousands of these things and making a call on what it was. Is this a full service restaurant? Is this a fast food joint? Is this a bar with food? Those are the places that we looked at. And so we drew all that out And the analysis came up with 1,216 restaurants or fast food joints or counter service places or bars with food, places that we consider the the competitive landscape of New Orleans restaurants in Orleans Parish. And that's as of May 2018. So it was very, very recent when we published the story. Now, what does that number tell you? That is 24% more than it was pre-Katrina. Now, you cut it up a little differently. Take full-service restaurants, 33% more than it was before Hurricane Katrina. So a third more, that's a lot.
And a smaller population.
And a smaller population. But it gets complex, Brian, because, yes, the population is smaller. Is it a little wealthier? Is it a little better off? Do they go out more often? Have trends and lifestyles changed? Do people eat out more often than they do before? There's a lot of signs that say that they do. And then there's the X factor of, in this town, extremely important, tourism. You know, there's a whole other population that is, you know, doesn't live here, but comes here and comes here to eat. And maybe they're here for 2 days, maybe they're here for a week, but they're here. And most of them have a eating itinerary.
Food and music, right? That's why people come here.
right. So, you know, there's still a lot of those factors out there. But what we were able to do is put together the numbers of like, look, this is where it was pre-Katrina. That's a good benchmark. Here's where it is now. Here's how it's grown over the years. And what we saw when we charted it was not this wild peak, you know, this wild rise that would tell you, oh my God, what is happening? It's been a steady, gradual, but always pointing upward line of more. Something else we were able to draw out of that was pretty interesting is, what are the hardest months for these restaurants? Which, you know, intuitively it is the summertime. But, you know, we found some numbers to prove that. We could tell when the last permits of these restaurants were, when they closed in any given year. And it turns out almost half of them, 46%, happen in the hot summer months.
Right.
So, you know, if a restaurant is going to close, pretty good chance it's going to happen in June, July, August. Yeah, and maybe even September.
Now, do you think it's changed, Ian, a little bit too? And we'll get more into this when we do the podcast only segment, so I'll encourage folks to listen to that.
Sure.
Because it seems that we're maybe also getting people that are understanding that better, and then to borrow a term, the juice is not worth the squeeze. So people are cashing in the chips coming into summer, saying, "Hey, it's May, and here's where I'm at, and I'm not going to do it again through the summer."
Yeah, in the restaurant business, you know, That is the time in New Orleans. It's, you know, people are the season is fall through Jazz Fest, maybe Mother's Day.
Right.
And then after that, you're looking at a very slow season. And what a lot of restaurateurs have told me in different parts of the restaurant business is that it's really hard to make money in the summertime. That a lot of times they feel like they're treading water. They're even maybe just paying back some of the money that they made. You know, and what we got into in our reporting at The Advocate was that, you know, different restaurants have different ways of managing it. Some of them have been quite successful with it. Some of them, I wouldn't say anybody looks forward to it, but they've made the best out of an inevitably bad downturn by using that as a time to sharpen the sword, as some of them say,
sure.
To take a break or to do some renovations, to close the restaurant for a week.
Do some staff training, let them go on vacation.
Encourage them to go on vacation.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And one of the big struggles is with staffing. That's a huge part of the industry, a big part of the expense of the restaurants, probably the main thing, right?
Yep.
And they managing your staff is really, really, really important, people have told me, because you really don't have enough work for them in the summertime. But boy, when October hits, it's like a faucet goes off. Suddenly the season is on. You want all hands on deck. You want your people there and happy to be there and eager to be there because you need them. You need them all. Yeah. And that's the busy, the crazy time. You know, and that's what the cycle looks like. Now, the dynamic here that's changed is the number of restaurants. You know, it's been hot in New Orleans since pretty much the you know, the days of creation.
Right, right.
But you know, and ever since it's been,
I thought you meant a trend. No, it's just, okay. Yeah. No, climatologically, since, absolutely.
Yeah, let's go back to the start here, Brian. Yeah, you know, as soon as Bienville planted the flag, he's like, I'm not opening a restaurant here in the summertime. No way. But
Ian, do me a favor, because we've got about 30 seconds left before we have to close the radio program.
Okay.
So say what you're going to say.
Simply that more restaurants are exacerbating what has always been a bad situation. So, you know, the restaurateurs are having to find more creative ways to deal with that.
And keep it going through the summer months.
Absolutely.
Well, hey, friends, here's what we're going to do. We're going to close out the radio portion of the show, and then Ian's going to stick around. We're going to go further down this rabbit hole, if you will. We're not going to prognosticate about it being hot, because it's always hot here in the summer. just the way it is. And we're going to come back for another shot with Noel Drinks. We're going to continue chatting with Ian McNulty. So friends, remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until then, cheers, y'all. All right, everybody, thanks for hanging out for another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Yep, the theme song Saints and Sinners by our good friends, the fantastic band Bon Bon Vivant. Check them out, bbvband.com. Yeah, we got two conversations, as you know, coming up here on another shot. We're going to jump right back into our interview here in just a second with Ian McNulty, restaurant and food writer for the New Orleans Advocate newspaper. And then from the top of the show, we're going to continue our conversation with Gary Solomon Jr., co-chair of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. And then I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody, welcome to another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for hanging out with us. I appreciate it. And yeah, we're chatting here with Ian McNulty, who is the food and restaurant writer for the New Orleans Advocate newspaper. And Ian, let's touch on this for a second, just because we're talking about this off air. We got Tales of the Cocktail coming up, and this is Aaron right about now when people are hearing that. Great event coming up in town. What are you looking forward to with that, man? What are you going to do?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how this year goes. I think it's pretty well known by people who follow this that this is a new start for Tales of the Cocktail. They have a new leadership. They have a new format. They're a foundation now, a nonprofit foundation.
They've and that's Tony. We just had Gary on just a little bit ago.
He's giving you the 411 on that. I think this is this is a great event for New Orleans because it brings in all these people right when we need them in July. And it's the thing about it is it's not just that it brings people in, whatever. It's what it is. It's cocktails. It's bars. It's hospitality. It's what we do. This is our industry. We're an industry town. The way that Hollywood makes movies and the way that Boston makes championship sports teams. Like, we make hospitality, food and restaurants. And I think it's awesome to have that. I think it's great to have all those people coming here. I think it increases the brand of New Orleans. And I think it helps like draw talent to town. You know, I think there's a lot of people who have probably come here and started doing their own thing, at least had their own tenure here. Thanks to the introduction for that. So I'm looking forward to having a great crowd in town in New Orleans, eating and drinking. I love going out even to like non Tales of the Cocktail events, just like around town.
We have those.
Oh, let's just say not an event from Tales of the Cocktail,
but
just around town. No, go to Lafitte Blacksmith Shop, go to Aaron Rose, go to the old Absinthe
anyway.
House.
Yeah. Tenures change anyway, so we're fine.
Yeah, just go anywhere where bartenders congregate, and you're gonna have like a fun crowd, right? I mean, these are people who like to party, who know the industry, or tipping well. It's just kind of fun to be in the mix with that. The seminars are, I'm sure, good and important for people in the industry, for civilians like me who are on the outside looking in. It's just a super interesting time to have like all these people who are passionate about this topic come to town and explore your city, and you know, you're drinking with pros all of a sudden.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, and since we're on this topic, just because I think it's interesting, one of the questions I always ask people, it'd be great to hear your perspective on this, is that we can talk about the so-called craft cocktail renaissance in 99, 2000, whatever, however we want to chalk it up, call it, pushing 20 years ago.
Yeah.
you know, New Orleans, now maybe we got a little thin in the vodka years of the 60s and 70s, where, you know, but you could always get a Sazerac, you could always get an Old Fashioned, maybe not necessarily always done well, and yeah. so on, but it was always here. So we can argue maybe that this was the original craft cocktail town in the city. Mm-hmm. So when you come here and how, you know, rectifying that concept of new stuff versus this line of tradition that really never went away like it did, I think it's kind of an interesting... It's an interesting line to walk, interesting balance, interesting story to talk about.
Well, I think that, great point, Brian. I think it resonates all across the world of food and drink. Like, it, the trends are amazing. They're so fun to follow. There's a lot of money to be made in them for people in the business. But what really gives anything in this realm its soul, its identity, its bones is the context and the history where it comes from. And that's what New Orleans has always had. I mean, it's dripping with it, right? And yeah, even before people were fluent in the terminology of craft cocktails and all this stuff, New Orleans was known as a town that loved a good drink, that had invented many of them, that still maintained these bars and restaurants where hospitality was not just something you did for a couple of years between jobs, but was your calling.
Profession, yes.
Your profession that extended to the bar, extended to bartenders. And New Orleans has, I would say it has the cultural anchors for, you know, a higher appreciation of cocktails to make more sense, right? It's not just like plop down in the new snazzy places. It's permeated into all these places where people convene and eat and drink. I mean, it's our pursuit. It's a cultural pursuit here. It's also big business. It's what people do. So right. It made sense for this stuff to happen here. Now, you know, in any kind of trend, anything that catches fire, where people can make money and where people can market things and make a name for themselves, you're going to have things that go too far, get a little ridiculous, go towards the mass market and get a little cheesy. But there's always going to be like appealing back from that to the places that have always done this well. Maybe they've upped their game as a result. You know, it's I enjoy seeing the new attention to the old places in New Orleans that that are on the list for people who are cocktail aficionados and enthusiasts to go around and see. I mean, let's face it, you're visiting New Orleans. You're not coming here for the sweeping mountain views and the white sand beaches. You know? Right. If you are, you got conned, right. Okay? Right. Like somebody's right. conned.
You're looking up at the water. Yeah. That's the only thing you're looking up at. Well, yeah. And I think you raise a great point, because I'm remiss in mentioning this, because we are, of course, here sitting at Two Jacks, which is the second oldest restaurant in the city, and our mutual friend Paul Gustings, who is now back here running the bar. Paul's been a bartender in New Orleans since the 70s. Yeah. So Paul is, Paul predates the term mixologist by quite some time.
He's a no bullshit kind of guy. I can say that, right?
You can say that.
Podcast.
Oh, he's a no bullshit. Okay, he'll just say, fuck you, I'm a bartender.
Okay, yeah. Paul's the ultimate no bullshit kind of guy, right? I mean, he knows what he's doing. He has his chops and, you know, he doesn't have to twirl the mustache for anybody. You know, what he does with his facial hair is
he does
his own
wear
business.
A vest.
Yes. Well, that's true. Is, but
that's questionable.
Yeah. He was. Good point. In the summertime, yeah, you do have to wonder what the motivation is, Paul. Someday that can be his hot seat question next time you have him on the show.
Right. I'll call it an affectation. But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But the point, Brian, is I think you're getting at this too, is that, you know, there's. It's one thing for the cocktail trend to materialize in any old place or that, you know, where people are just hawking it. And it's another for, for people with an appreciation for this stuff to come to a place where this is what we do. This is one of the reasons we attract people and draw people and how we entertain them. You know, the cocktail bar is not just the thing on that you do after hitting the slopes here, right? You're coming here to do the cocktail bar.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And then hit the mattress.
Right, exactly. I mean, we see the number of cocktail tours that just and food tours that roll through this establishment.
Sure.
In particular.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a time-honored tradition here, and I think that's an important part. We did, and I know we can kind of argue using this term again, semantics on a different level, because we're talking about that off air, but. I would argue that the term mixologist has been created on some levels because bartender was a denigrating term.
Yeah, they needed some way to differentiate. Well, I'm doing this over here. I'm not just slinging drinks over there. Whatever. I think it's come back to, you know, it's come back around already. You know, I know most people in the business that I respect crinkle their nose at that term, would not self-apply it at all. may be too polite to correct you if you use it, but would certainly never apply it to themselves. They're bartenders, you know, they're in the hospitality business.
They're professionals.
They're pros. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and this is a town where that has a very long-standing tradition. You know, there are waiters in this town who make great money because they have, you know, a clientele that they've developed in the same way that a real estate agent would have their own, you know, their own black book of contacts. It is what we do. We're an industry town. And which is, you know, another reason why I always tell people when they visit here, you know, you're a tourist, whatever. But, you know, if you're going to restaurants and bars, if you're taking a good intentional approach at it, going to some interesting places, if you're choosing your path carefully, you're doing exactly what New Orleans people do. You are having the right, most authentic cultural experience you could possibly have in New Orleans, because that is what New Orleans people do, what they obsess about, what they talk about. This isn't like going to a city and doing a star tour, or like, you know, going somewhere and doing the, you know, the wax museum or something. I mean, this is going to restaurants and bars, talking about them incessantly, comparing them, knocking things off your bucket list, revisiting old favorites. This is what New Orleans people do, mm-hmm. and this is what we talk about. So if you're a visitor and you're doing those things, you're one of us. Welcome. You know, yeah. you're being 100% authentic to what New Orleans is.
You're rubbing shoulders with us. And actually, when we're sitting at a bar, we know that information is transmitted shoulder to shoulder in a bar in this town better than just about anywhere else. Call it the Coconut Telegraph or whatever you want to call it. But this is what we're talking about. Absolutely. Well, let me bring it back to this for a second, because we were talking about the restaurant setting. I don't want to continue to flog that. But for folks that are more interested in the industry, one of the things that I said, I was talking about the report, and I gave you all full credit, by the way. I didn't try and hog any of this. But, you know, I think what you did by hanging some numbers on some stuff is you reset the conversation, or gave us some things to talk about as a starting point. And some of the things that you were talking about before about, you know, these are more studies and more stories to be told that come from the study.
Yeah.
And gave us a baseline even to talk about a little bit.
Well, it's what happens every year in New Orleans. You know, the summertime comes. Some restaurants close, some of them not so surprising, some of them shockers to people who, you know, aren't, you know, haven't paid attention to them in a while maybe. And, you know, you start hearing people saying the sky is falling. Well, that's it. You know, here comes this, everything's closing down. We've reached
the tipping
correction point.
Is coming, right? The market correction is coming.
Yeah, the bubble has burst, right? There's no bubble, right? I mean, the New Orleans restaurant scene has been growing. So the number of tourists, so the way that people eat out, you know, are there too many restaurants? I don't really know. You know, some people say that there are, especially people who have been in the business, but you know, the next person always thinks there's room for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who's going to tell them that they can't be the one who's going to make it next? Who can tell them that they're not going to be the one who's going to have that killer idea, or is just going to like hit this chord in their neighborhood and become the most popular place? Because it happens all the time. Like, mm-hmm. they're not wrong to try.
Absolutely.
So, you know, these things, you know, the industry does keep growing. More people are coming into it. I think that they have to be smarter now, because there are so many more players in the game. I think that you have to really know who your audience is going to be. You have to have a plan for how you're going to make it through the very slow doldrums of the New Orleans summer, which is longer than anybody really imagines before they go through one. You know, when it's September, right, and the rest of the country is wearing sweaters and going into football season.
Don't be naive, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's the absolute nadir for New Orleans. That's the worst. That's the worst time for New Orleans is September. And then, you know, the switch flips in October, and the good times are here again through Jazz Fest, and you know, people can do really well. But they have to be smart, and you know, you have to follow some of the examples, right, of the people who've been around for 20, 30 of these summers and somehow made it. And there are examples out there, some of those that we documented in those stories you're talking about. But yeah, I thought it was important to put some numbers behind this conversation, because it is pervasive. It is something that people talk about a lot. And it can be a little scary, right? Like, people are attached to their restaurants in New Orleans, and when you see one close that you know, had fond memories of and that was important to you, it can be kind of a blow, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, oh, that place is gone. I thought it was always going to be there.
Right.
We're lucky in this town that a lot of restaurants are seemingly always there. But if, you know, if the numbers don't work out, if something changes, if the lease goes bad, if the property turns over, if a
kids
partnership
don't
ends,
to take it over.
Kids, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's a great point. I mean, that happens quite often. You're like, oh, what happened to that business? It was a great business. Well, you know, at some point, 70-year-old restaurateur wanted to retire, and his kids are in engineering. They're making way more money than they ever will in the restaurant business.
Yeah, you know, hated it because they grew up around it and don't want to do it.
Precisely.
You know? I mean,
precisely.
Any number of things.
Yeah, you see it all over. You see it all over, and it is sad. I mean, I love these restaurants. I love their stories, but the truth of it is, the turnover is part of the business. You know, we are lucky in New Orleans that we have places that will continue through generations, and that, you know, it's I've heard from many restaurateurs and even waiters that say, I knew this customer now when he was a kid. Now he's bringing his own kids in, that sort of thing. I love stories like that, right? But that the hard truth is that's not always going to be the case. But the upside, the beautiful upside, is that, you know, there's always somebody else who wants to give it a go, and they're going to have some new ideas, and maybe they're going to have some great ideas. And we've been eating a lot better in this town, I think, in the last, decade plus since Katrina, because of a lot of those new ideas that have come to the table. The best ideas, I think, though, are the ones that recognize where they are, that recognize that they aren't just anywhere, that they can't just plant this concept anywhere at all and expect to happen, that they are in this particular food city. They are in New Orleans. They do have this access to this clientele who is crazy about food, but also is very attached to a sense of New Orleans. New Orleans,
a sense of
too.
Place. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, it's a unique market, which makes it fascinating, which makes it great to cover and really great to eat in. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Ian, do me a favor. Tell people where they can find your column online and find The Advocate.
Sure. Yeah. The NewOrleansAdvocate.com is the main entry point for what I do. I write. I do the food coverage there, through columns, news report, gumshoe kind of stuff, and some critiques still, reviews. I also do a little show on WWNO, the local NPR radio station here.
Very good, Ian. Thank you very much, buddy. We'll have to do this again because I want to talk about like gumshoeing in the restaurant industry
okay.
sometime as well. There's a lot of gum over here on Madison, right here. We're sitting outside of Two Checks. There's a lot of horseshit too, or mule shit, I should say. But anyway, Ian, thank you so much for being here, man. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure, Brian. Anytime.
Thanks.
Cheers.
We'll do it again soon. Friends, hey, we're going to take a little break here on the show. Come on back. All right, everybody, hope you enjoyed the rest of that chat with Ian McNulty from the New Orleans Advocate. We'll get Ian back on one of these days soon, I hope. And here we go with the next part of Another Shot with Nola Drinks, our ongoing conversation here with Gary Solomon Jr. from Tales of the Cocktail. Check it out. All right, everybody. Hey, it's Another Shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in here on the podcast today. I appreciate it wherever you may be. And yes, if you're hearing this, if you're hearing this and you're at Tales of the Cocktail, you're probably at the beginning or the middle of Tales of the Cocktail. So we're chatting here with Gary Solomon Jr., who is the co-chair of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. And Gary, as we hear are on the podcast portion of the show, one of the things we talked about this at the top of the show, which everybody has heard on the podcast as well, you come from a philanthropic background with your family. This is an important part about how Tales, if you will, the foundation is being retooled to be a true educational foundation to address broader issues in the industry. And as we noted at the top of the show, this is a kind of a meeting ground, a vanguard, if you will, for a lot of the issues that our broader society faces. And taking that opportunity to use Tales to address that, I know, is near and dear to your heart.
Look, that's why we're here. I mean, we come to New Orleans in this event to advance our own personal growth, right? And to get deeper education in certain areas that we want, whether it's how to run our bars or about the spirits themselves. But really what's different this year is that the byproduct of being here at Tales is by spending the dollars that you did to be here, you're directly funding the grant programs that we are going to announce this year as well. And so it's not just that you're, you know, improving yourself, you're improving the industry by being here, just by way of that the profits are all going back into the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. And our mission is not just as an educational foundation, it's to give away money and to give away real money,
right?
And so in year one, and although it's going to be a very tough year for us, we know, because you know, the startup of a new organization and all that goes into retooling it is an expensive proposition. But we committed to $250,000 of grants awards this year. And so we are announcing this year in very early part of the week who the recipients of those grants programs are going to be. And they're from incredible I've seen the list. I was very excited to be part of the group that got to approve the list, although it was fully selected by a group of industry folks. The board did get a chance to approve it and offer our feedback. And it crosses into a lot of different areas: sustainability, diversity, healthcare, mental well-being, you name it. It's really, the opportunity to do good here is tremendous. And by being here at Tails, you're doing good.
I think that's great, Gary. It's a great point. One of the conversations that we had, or part of the conversation that we had with Caroline recently, your executive director, was, I think you guys are very good at this. I come from a very long nonprofit background myself. Okay. And you have experience both receiving grants and also funding grants. And one of the take-home messages that I took from her that I thought was a strong positive was, you guys use this opportunity, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to listen and learn from your audience, to use that as a vehicle to identify key issues, as opposed to saying, these are exclusively the key issues that we think we're going to fund. You guys use this as an opportunity to learn, I think, to identify issues, if I'm not mistaken. And when you're starting a grant program, I think that's critical to go about it that way.
Absolutely. We did more listening than we've done talking in the last 6 months. What few interviews we've done have probably been outnumbered, 100-fold by the amount of listening that we've done. And even in the grants process, we knew that the decision about where the industry's $250,000 should go should not come necessarily just from us. It should be at the direction of your peers and the leaders that really know what's happening on a daily basis in the lives of bartenders and spirits professionals. And so we assembled a group of just about over a dozen of leaders and progressive folks in the industry. We convened a couple times by phone, and then once we had a great all-day summit in New York, and which is where everyone happened to be for another event. And we vetted, I think, over 150 initial requests for grant funding. We culled it down to about 50 or so. It went on to the second round, and the slate that will be presented is really indicative, I think, of what we've heard that the issues are, and those that we think we can help tackle in year one. We can't do it all in year one.
Absolutely.
And it's just the start.
Part of a grant program, I think, and you know this very well, a successful grant program is actually funding projects that can be successful. And that's
Absolutely.
Trickier than it sounds.
No, it's true, because there are a lot of great, a lot of needs were presented. A lot of ideas that were like amazing were presented, but did they have the team and the resources to put our money that comes from the industry's participation in Tails at the event, did they have the resources and the means and the team to put it to good use and make a difference? And so I hope what we'll see is that next year some of those grants that didn't quite make it through this year will come back, will be available to kind of coach them through where we saw opportunities for improvement and things to refine, because we intend to do this every year. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that some of the grants requests that maybe weren't quite ready yet to be funded can make another run at it and retool things a little bit, because this is not going to be a 1 year project. This is hopefully a lifetime commitment.
This is a commitment. It's really a centerpiece of the foundation. Right?
It is, and it's a centerpiece for our family now.
Sure,
we've really owned. We've taken this on, and we've really owned this responsibility. We've traveled now all over the country and the world in the last 6 months to meet people and hear the stories of how Tails has made a difference in their lives, but also what Tails could do for them better. Mm-hmm. And so we thought was taking on a responsibility of keeping an event in New Orleans. We now have this grand opportunity, and we hope that through the involvement of folks in the industry who really know it best, that we can provide them a platform to be successful.
I think that's great. And what are your thoughts, again, coming from a perspective of having some experience in the grant world too, when you look at, say, this party's got a great idea, this party's got a great idea, they're very similar, they're
maybe
both not quite
together.
There. Maybe you should all, and you got to be kind of be careful in how you do that, but I think that's a great approach.
We've
as well.
Talked about it, and I don't know that this year we necessarily matched anybody
probably
up,
not
but,
feasible,
but there was a couple opportunities we saw where we said, y'all all speaking about the same problem, you've all got very similar solutions, maybe we should try to bring people together. And so I know that one of the things we want to do, there's a couple issues that we didn't feel like we could fully tackle, that we could really make a difference in with the amount of money we had this year, and things that needed more opportunity for discussion with more input. So I think what we're going to do is facilitate some roundtable conversations throughout the year around those issues, in hopes that it breeds grant applications that directly hear that feedback and the input from others, and present projects that can be sustainable and can be implemented that can make a difference next year. So
Great.
We've got a long road ahead here.
Absolutely. Hey, and as you said, Gary, it's really just the beginning, right? So, it's a learning process for everyone involved,
Totally.
Yourselves included, which I think think is also very exciting, frankly.
It is. You know, one thing, everybody's talking about what's changing. I'll tell you one thing that's not changing, and that's the CAPS program. The CAPS program is incredible.
So the Cocktail Apprentice the program. Cocktail so people Apprentice know what we're program.
Yeah, we, now they've. I was not familiar with the acronym early on. Now I've fully adopted the acronym CAPS. But the Cocktail Apprentice program, having met some of these folks in Edinburgh, and hearing the stories about how it's changed their career trajectories, their opportunities for employment, and just their professionalism behind the bar and in their own professional lives, it's just amazing. And so that's one thing that I think that Tails hit the mark on from day one.
Yes.
And we intend not to mess with that because it is so perfect the way that it is. We'll give it all the support that it needs because those stories are really why we're here as well.
Right. And then it's a great program. And let's just talk about that for a second because if Cocktail Apprentice program, I was surprised, Gary, maybe start here. This goes back a number of years towards one of the first few Tails that I went to and started to know a handful of people from here that had become CAPS. Okay. And some of the people that I knew, they were incredibly talented bartenders, had worked in the industry for a number of years, people that had won awards in cocktail competitions for that matter. And I would ask them, I'm like, why are you doing an apprentice program? You already seem you're like at least a journey person at this point. right. And people are like, no, you don't understand the opportunity of what you learn, who you get to network with. That's one part about it that maybe you can speak to. And then also, let's just be frank, these people that go to the CAP program, they work their ass off during Tales of the Cocktail.
Yeah. I mean, just the volume, the thousands of drinks that they're batching for the, you know, what, six, we have 70 or so seminars this year, I think.
Okay.
I mean, and that number is actually down a little bit from past year because I know that the other hotel, the Sonesta, was under construction, so we didn't have access to all those ballrooms. But, I mean, they're batching incredible amounts of drinks. They're turning them fast. They're keeping it organized.
Early morning, which is not normally for the lifestyle.
Early morning, late night. And we saw it in a small way in Edinburgh at the Tales on Tour event, and it was amazing how they came in there, and it was like what was most unique to me about this program and what speaks really highly about the folks who lead it was that they brought in a group of, you know, bringing in effectively 65 strangers together is what they will do. And then somehow over the course of a week, they become a well-oiled machine that, you know, the best bars in the world only dream that they could have their team working that well together.
Right.
And they do that in they do orientation, onboarding, getting to know you, how we work, go right into production and clean up and shut down all in a matter of a week. And they didn't even know each other before they walked in the door.
It's
and that's
fantastic.
Amazing.
It creates a fraternity too, right? You see these relationships last years.
You know, they all have pineapple tattoos. Have you heard this?
I have. I've seen some.
I've seen most of them now. I've seen a lot of pineapple tattoos. I'm not getting one, by the way, because I'm not going to be a cat.
You're not going to be
qualified.
A cat,
and
have to wear the red coat. Yeah, me neither. I'll
exactly.
just admire the artwork on their arm and admire the cocktails that they make.
No, it's really cool. And they say that, you know, they've got this group now where, you know, they pop on Facebook into the CAPS group that's a closed group and ask a question to and people from all over the world are answering the question that, you know, there's no encyclopedia to reference quite like the knowledge of all these folks. So it's really exciting that will not change. And that is something we're going to prop up and we're going to really make sure that the CAPS program is well taken care of.
That's fantastic, Gary. Well, thanks. Do you have, as we close out here on this portion of the show, any sort of welcome message you want to give to everybody here?
Hey, my welcome is just to have a really good time here. You know, embrace the opportunity you have to meet new people. Really go do the local stuff. If you can like break away for, not that I want you to break away from Tails for long, but like take a moment and go do something local as well, because Tails is incredible in the way that it takes over the city, but there's also a lot of hidden local gems here that are worth spending a few minutes with as well. So I know if you ask any locals what their favorite things are to do, they will willingly share those with you. And I encourage you to get off our schedule at some point for just a moment, but then come right back to the party.
And get around town.
Yeah.
There you go. That sounds great. Gary, thanks for taking some
time.
I appreciate it.
It's fun.
My pleasure. Friends, Gary Solomon Jr. from the Tails of the Cocktail Foundation. Hey, we're going to take a brief musical interlude and I'll be back with my parting shot. Come on back. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening in this week on the NOLA Drinks Show. As always, I appreciate it. We're here with our parting shot. Wanted to mention next week's show. As we know, we are here in the midst, the throes of Tales of the Cocktail, and a lot of stuff's going to be running on the show in the ensuing weeks. From Tales, and next week's show will feature an interview with a new executive director, Caroline Rosen, who is going to be rejoining us again. She was on just a few weeks back, along with Tiffany Barrier, the drinking coach, also a member of the Grants Committee, talks about that stuff, and Kiata Mincy, also a very talented bartender. Both Tiffany and Kiata are from Atlanta. So a great conversation that we just recently had with them. That's going to be next week's show, talking about the grant program at Tales of the Cocktail and some other good stuff going on in that world. And we'll have lots of good shows coming up. We're going to be running all kinds of cool stuff. But hey, wanted to mention, I hope you enjoyed those interviews there with Ian and Gary. And something that we touched on pretty strongly in the interview with Ian was the sort of, you know, our sense of place that we have here in New Orleans. But I think you got it really from both interviews, right? In that I think when we talked to Gary and understanding the importance that we all share, but the new leadership at Tales of the Cocktail shares with keeping that important event here in New Orleans. It's economically important in July, but there's a spiritual connection to this, right? We talk about New Orleans maybe arguably being the original, I don't even think there's much of an argument, the original craft cocktail city on the planet, right? And I always ask that question. If you listen to the show regularly, you know I ask people, we have this so-called craft cocktail renaissance that took place 1999-2000. Well, we kind of always had something like that going on here. And I always think that how the new trends in cocktails, how they manifest here in New Orleans, I think is an interesting consideration because it sits in a landscape that wasn't just created. There was already something here. There was something that it had to slot into. But getting back to what I was saying with this sort of sense of place here is that it really does define much of the city of New Orleans, as well as the varied cultures and individuals and neighborhoods and so on and so forth that we have here. There's arguably a bit of an overlap. Now, I'm not saying that all things are equal here. Far from it. These are issues for other shows. But there is a sense of place here in New Orleans that, to a degree, some of us all share. Now, exactly how that plays out in our own world and what our perception of it is may not be, it's certainly not exactly the same as you look at different folks across the city, different groups across the city, different neighborhoods, as I said. But there's something there. There's something that we understand about this sense of place here in New Orleans. And one thing I think is you either get it or you don't. So if you're from here, you get it because you were born into it. If you've moved here, some people, you know, this place either clicks for you or it doesn't. And I find that a lot of people have a hard time looking past. If you can't look past some of the bad things in New Orleans and you see the greatness that it really is and the wonder of the culture, the architecture, the food, the music, the whole thing that we talk about here, and you're focused on other things, and you're just not going to get it. And you see a lot of people move here, and 6 months later, they're gone. And then you see other people who plan to be here for vacation or be here for 6 months to do a temporary gig, and they never left. This sense of place, as we talked about with Ian, relates to our favorite cocktail. It relates to our favorite restaurants, and much of the scene, the restaurant scene, that is so important to the tourism industry, which, of course, as we know, is the most important industry in New Orleans for the sake of the economy, but just culturally, part of our cultural identity. Restaurants make up a significant portion of what that is, and it dictates a lot of where we go and how we do. And it's something that you really can't take away, and it's something that's hard to explain, but it's also something that if you don't understand it, you probably don't understand it. And I think that there's, when somebody tries to open up a new restaurant here, I think there's a wide berth in New Orleans of what fits. There's a lot of things that can be very accepting here, but not too wide. I think sometimes it's not quite as an open world as some people might think. And I think we've seen a lot of people move down here that have tried, you know, hey, I'm a great sous chef. I did this great gig up north somewhere, out west somewhere, and I think I'm ready to open a restaurant. And New Orleans is this sort of magical land, right? After Katrina, it was seen as this sort of place where you could go and be successful and open a restaurant. I think, one, we're seeing a hard correction, as I think we noted in the interview with Ian and other conversations we've had on this on the show. But I also think that it's something where it's not quite as easy as somebody thinks, because there is that sense of place here. There's that longstanding tradition of what it is that we do and how the restaurant scene, the bar scene, makes up so much of the bedrock of the culture. You have to slot into what that is. And now that the restaurant industry has experienced so many closures and constant new openings and these things. And we talk about this sort of potential threat to this. Nick Dietrich of Manolito said this a few weeks back on the show. Is this a new normal where it's sort of like Manhattan, where it's expected that the life cycle, the life expectancy of a new restaurant is about 2 years? That's not what the restaurant industry is based on in New Orleans. There's a traditional component to this here. It is that sense of place that we talk about. And I think that we see, hopefully, that there is a little bit of a correction and we're returning to a little bit of some sanity here and some sense of normal, and people are a little more cautious in what it is that they're doing when they look to open a new place. I think we're starting to see that, for example, people are, restaurant consultants and others in the industry are telling people to slow down, think for a second. You need to be capitalized. We talk a lot about that on this show, that, you know, you have to have more than 3 months worth of money in the bank if you're going to open up a restaurant in this town. You need to have the staying power to work your way into the scene, to work your way into this place. And if you're not prepared to do that, and if you're not bringing the right concept here, no matter how good your food is or even how good your service is, it's not going to fly. So I know I'm being a little bit abstract here, and I think it's a little bit vague, and it's sort of this zeitgeist, if you will, of what is New Orleans and how that works and this sense of place that we have here. But you need to understand that if you're going to open up a new restaurant. So it's really not just if you build it, they will come. It really is if you build it, they will come if you put it in the right sense of place. Friends, that's our parting shot for this show. And hey, I hope you tune in next week. We're going to have a lot of fun coming up here with Tales of the Cocktail. Stay tuned for more on that. Here's to you. I'll be saying, I'll be seeing as we try.